Lovins and you know, that cast of characters that is well known in the field of sustainability thinking and practice, I quickly discovered that energy is the number one environmental driver on the planet. It's the most energy, I mean, it's the most polluting, and it's also the most capital-intensive industry on the globe. And I got my first intro into energy was in energy efficiency. I wrote a contract for the State Energy Office of New Mexico to design and implement an energy efficiency program to help owners of large buildings, mainly in the private sector, but also in the public and nonprofit sector, to reduce their utility bills through energy efficiency. And the cool thing about that, of course, is that it's market-driven. It's one of the places where environmental improvement and economic improvement go hand-in-hand, so undeniably that businesses will buy into the system. So I did that in New Mexico starting in the late 90s until really just I ended my contract with them at the end of 2003, even though I hadn't been in New Mexico for 2 years at that point. I came out here. I also got a contract with the Department of Energy, which may scare some folks, but there was and still is a little tiny corner of the Department of Energy, which has some people who are really trying to do the right thing in terms of implementing energy efficiency. And I took the model that I developed in New Mexico and talked the Department of Energy into allowing me to try to implement that nationwide. And then within a few months of George Bush getting elected, the funding for my program was pulled. And so I said, okay, I've been saving the world one building at a time. I'm going to go to Antioch, get my master's degree in environmental advocacy, the new program that they were just starting. I was in the first cohort. And I figured I'll try to do something a little more aggressive, a little more outrageous with the years remaining to me to really try to make a difference. Because I think we're at a really critical stage here on the planet. And I think it's going to take a lot of effort by a lot of people, and it's going to take some sacrifices. You know, I mean, as an example, I could be paid an awful lot more working in the private sector than working in the public. The nonprofit sector. The nonprofit sector, you don't make a lot of money usually, unless you're the head of United Way or something like that. But generally, people working in the nonprofit sector take a significant salary reduction, and people do it because they want to make a difference, and there's a reward, a significant reward to those who want to make a difference. It's part of the price we pay is not making a lot of money, but you know that's okay. It's more significant to me when I look at my own personal life. I have grandchildren now, and I want to be able to look back and have my grandchildren and my great grandchildren look to me with a sense of pride that of what I did. You know, I want to leave a legacy of really doing something significant to make the world a better place. You know, and it takes a lot of people doing that. And there are a lot of people out there doing that who are driven by those ideals, especially in a world where the opposite extreme, sort of the get rich quick at all expenses that was sort of inculcated into the American consciousness, or glorified, I should say. It's been in the American consciousness for a long time, but it was really glorified under Ronald Reagan, and it's really glorified under the current administration. And when George Bush got elected, for example, enrollment at Antioch started going up. So
I think there's a connection.
Oh, there's a definite connection. You know, it's a polarity. When people see the world starting to go to pieces, those who care start caring more, and start your threshold of what you're willing to do and what you're willing to sacrifice starts going up a lot.
Indeed. So let's get right to it. Let's get right to the issue of nuclear energy. Tell us what the position of NEC is on nuclear energy in the United States and around the world today. What do we need to know about
this? New England Coalition is one of the most long-lived I'll call it a safe energy group because it's more than just anti-nuke. In New England, we were started in 1971 specifically to oppose the licensing of Vermont Yankee. There was a gathering of scholars, scientists, professors, a full range of people in the community got together on actually February 5th. So yesterday was our 34th anniversary.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, well, thank you. But we've been going strong ever since then, and we have focused at, on different reactors at different times. We spent 18 years fighting Seabrook, and so we sort of our presence in this community diminished during that time. But it came back strong after Vermont Yankee, at the point when Vermont Yankee was being sold by its owners, this collective owners, the Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Corporation, which was a conglomerate of mostly local utilities and New England utilities. They wanted to dump the plant. They were desperately afraid of the liabilities involved, the financial and other liabilities involved in this plant. And eventually they sold it to Entergy Corporation, which is a Louisiana-based multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporation that has 10 nuclear power plants around the country, five of them in New England, five down in the Delta region of Mississippi, and makes it the second largest privately held nuclear power, commercial nuclear power plant owner in the country. So they're a pretty powerful entity. And they came in... The general impression is that they came in thinking they'd be able to do any darn thing they wanted in Vermont. So the first thing they did after they bought the plant is they turned around and said, we're going to boost the reactor power in this 32-year-old nuclear reactor by 20%. And they have been going full steam ahead trying to implement that plan. They pushed it through the Vermont Public Regulatory process, the Public Service Board over in Vermont. They were going like a steamroller, and New England Coalition was the only citizen group, the only group in the state, in the region, to actually stand up and say, this is not a good plan. Taking a 32-year-old nuclear power plant that was designed when Lawrence Welk was on television and finished in 1972 and cranking it up so that it could generate 20% more heat and create more steam so they could drive the turbine faster and put a greater load on the turbine so that they could generate 20% more electricity, not because we need it, because Vermont doesn't need it, but because the company wanted to sell onto the wholesale market on the New England grid and make a ton of extra money. So Entergy, this out-of-state corporation, has a three-tiered plan. They want to boost the power. They want to create more room for more nuclear waste by taking the spent fuel, what they call the spent fuel, or the irradiated uranium fuel that is currently sitting in what they call the spent fuel pool, which is basically a 40 by 40 foot pool of water standing 60 feet above ground inside the reactor building, right next to the reactor body. They want to take that, that's getting full, so they want to take some of that spent fuel out and put it into dry cask storage, which means they would put it into these steel and concrete containers, which they would then set out on a concrete pad outside the reactor building.
Trash out behind the building kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, basically what they're doing is turning the southern Vermont into a nuclear waste dump.
So how dangerous are those dry cask containers?
Well, it's a really tricky issue. The most dangerous thing right now is the spent fuel pool. I mean, people are not really aware. Most people are not aware of the danger that's lurking there. But if you took the accident at Chernobyl, the amount of radioactive material that was released at Chernobyl is a small fraction of what is available in that spent fuel pool. And when they take the used uranium out of the reactor, it still is going through a radioactive decay process that makes it hot, physically hot, temperature hot, as well as radioactive hot.
Right.
That heat is so great, it's called decay heat, and it stays great for years and years and years. It's so great that if the water that is in that spent fuel pool were to drain out, the cladding on these fuel rods would spontaneously ignite as soon as the temperature reached something above 1,000 degrees. And once it ignited, it cannot be extinguished. And there is an inventory of radioactive materials in that spent fuel pool, like I say, many, many, many times greater than what was released at Chernobyl. Now, let's put things in perspective. And you said get out your Alka-Seltzer, and I don't want folks' eyes to glaze over, but I do want, you know, you to get the point that Keene is located 17 miles from the reactor in Vernon.
Right.
The way the crow flies and the way the wind, the prevailing wind blows, by the way.
That's right.
New Hampshire is at much greater risk in the event of a nuclear accident over there than Vermont is. And yet, New Hampshire has no say over the regulation of that plant, mm-hmm. other than what pressure you might be able to put on the elected officials and the regulatory bodies in Vermont, including the governor,
mm-hmm.
and also through your elected representatives, your senators, and your congressional delegation. That they can put pressure on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I strongly recommend, in fact, that you do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if this were Chernobyl, if that reactor was the Chernobyl reactor, Keene would be inside a circle that is permanently uninhabitable.
Boy, that gives you pause for reflection.
That should give some pause for reflection.
Yes, indeed.
Indeed. And just last year, there was a report out of the independent newspaper the London Independent, where dairy farmers or sheep farmers in Scotland could not sell their mutton from their sheep because it had such high levels of radioactivity from the Chernobyl accident, which was over 1,000 miles away, 18 years after the fact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just to give you a little bit of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they say that the Chernobyl accident can't happen here, but that really is a smokescreen, because technically, yes, it's true, it's a different type of reactor, so the same type of accident could not happen. The same sequence of events could not happen in the same way. But that's not to say that we couldn't have a nuclear meltdown. It's not to say that the spent fuel pool could get ruptured by a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's the number one terrorist target in this region. It is the only industrial target in this region of New England,
mm-hmm.
which could permanently render all three states and much of Canada and Maine and other parts of New England uninhabitable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only industrial target that could do that. So it's something we should be concerned about,
very sobering. On that note, I read in the Sentinel this week that the Vermont Nuclear Power Plant, I'm reading here from the article, will see increased inspections this year as a result of emergency notification problems that came to light last year. The plant earned a white finding of low to moderate safety significance following an inspection of the emergency alert notification system, said the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And is there something, what is going on there with the alert system? I mean, obviously the information that you're sharing in and of itself is a pretty big alert, but if something were to happen there, how would we find out about it right now?
Well, there is an emergency notification system that's multi-tiered. For Brattleboro and Vernon, they have sirens, that alert sirens that go off if there's a problem at that plant. If something goes wrong, as something did go wrong fairly recently when the big transformer fire that they had, where they had a huge short circuit in their what they call their buses, where the current is coming out of the generator building to the transformer from where it is distributed out into the New England grid. Those buses, one of the bus expansion joints in the bus broke loose. And it short-circuited the whole plant, I mean, that whole part of the plant, and it created a massive fire. There was flames shooting up 30 feet or so or more, and they called it a low level of emergency. It was not a nuclear emergency,
mm-hmm.
but it was enough to set off some systems. So they couldn't figure out, the people in the control room couldn't figure out how to work the phone to notify the emergency management people at the state.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a fairly complex system where the control room operators have to pick up a phone and provide a certain message. And then a signal goes out from the emergency management, then it gets relayed to different emergency management personnel and stations. Ultimately, a signal is sent out on an emergency radio transmitter, and it's a complicated process, but a transmitter sends out a signal to all the emergency radios that are set up to that particular frequency, and they're supposed to be distributed within the 10-mile, what they call emergency planning zone, or EPZ. Well, a lot of these radios aren't working. And a lot of the radios have backup batteries in case there's a power failure, but the batteries go dead and do not indicate that they're dead. You know, when you have a smoke alarm in your home, when a battery goes dead, it starts beeping.
Right.
Or you get some signal. Well, these emergency radios do not indicate mm-hmm. that the batteries are dead. So if the power goes out, and in a general emergency, if Vermont Yankee went down and there was a nuclear emergency, we could very well be looking also at a power outage, and these radios wouldn't be working because the batteries have died. And then they found out that a lot of the radios weren't receiving the signal at all,
mm-hmm.
that there was some discrepancy in how the signal was being generated from the transmitter to these radios. So this was all coming out during the last year, and a few months ago, New England Coalition filed what's called a 2.206 citizens petition, which is one of the only ways that the general population can have any impact on the nuclear regulatory process. And mm-hmm. it's a pretty convoluted process. Most people don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
New England Coalition does have that expertise, and we filed a petition asking that the NRC immediately put the plant into cold shutdown because they're operating illegally. They are required to have a functional emergency notification system. Well, Entergy convinced the NRC that they had set up an alternative system, which would be that the volunteers in the various towns in the emergency planning zone would go around with bullhorns up and down the streets driving in pickup trucks.
Oh, that's high-tech.
That's a total pipe dream anyway, and it's already been demonstrated that it's not a workable system. But if anybody thinks that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission really is out to do its job to protect the public, you really should think twice. And it sounds so cynical, but having been in this for a while, you see pretty quickly that their main function is to protect the industry against the public.
So what does somebody do here? What or how would we find out here in Keene?
In Keene, you would find out, eventually, you would find out through probably your state emergency management folks.
How long would that take, do you think?
Well, they're required by law to notify within 15 minutes of an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to be approximately 15 minutes. Well, they can't possibly do it right now in 15 minutes. Another thing that happened recently is they tried for the first time in 32 years. Imagine this. For the first time in 32 years, they tried to test the evacuation program for the school students. And almost 30 schools tried to participate in it, I think. The number may be wrong. But it was just in the Brattleboro area,
mm-hmm.
public and private schools both.
Mm-hmm.
And our system over there for evacuating the schools depends on school buses from New Hampshire going over to get the students from the Vermont schools and take them up to the reception center, they call it, up in Bellows Falls,
uh-huh.
which, generally speaking, is downwind of the reactor.
Mm-hmm.
The prevailing winds actually blow more in this direction from the southwest, so
yep.
the plume would most likely be coming in this direction. So people in New Hampshire really do have to wonder if there's an emergency and all the school buses are being pulled out of New Hampshire to go to Vermont, and the plume is coming this way, what's going to happen to your own school children?
What is going to happen?
Well, you should be asking that question of your own New Hampshire emergency management personnel.
Indeed. So help us put this in perspective. Realistically speaking, realistically meaning a type of problem that could happen within the realm of possibility, what kind of problem would that be, and how much time would we likely have if we needed to evacuate?
This is a really challenging question, and it's a vulnerable kind of a question to put me in trying to respond to it, because there's nothing that can lie like a statistic.
Yes.
In a Chernobyl kind of a circumstance, they could have a fast breaking emergency. And in Chernobyl, they had an explosion, and that was pretty quick. In terms of probability and risk, We really have to look at two things, and there's two aspects to risk the way insurance companies look at it. One is the probability of an accident, and the other is the consequences of an accident. Now, the probability of a major radioactive release is pretty low, based upon the history of the nuclear plants in America, at least, mm-hmm. if you accept Three Mile Island. If you look at the industry as a whole, however, the probability is a certainty. It's not a probability. It is a certainty that there will be a major nuclear accident somewhere. But then you get into the impacts of an accident, and they can range anywhere from virtually nothing up to catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, conservatively speaking, you should be planning for the worst-case scenario.
So we're looking at a 33-year-old reactor over there, and what is the life expectancy? What types of problems, just briefly, might what you expect to be happening with a reactor of that age, and what can be done about it?
Well, I can say this, I think, with some certainty, that their plans, Entergy's plans, to boost the reactor power at that nuclear plant, which is now 33 years old almost, those plans will have very clear consequences of reducing safety margins, increasing the speed at which an accident would develop if there was an accident, because they rearrange the geometry of the fissioning process inside the reactor core, so it expands the amount of area or the volume of uranium and brings it out closer to the edge of, instead of being just happening at the center of the core, mm-hmm. it actually expands the fission process out closer to the edges. There's more fission process going on. That means there, if there was a radiological release, it would happen faster and would happen in much greater quantities. So we can say, I think without any doubt, that Entergy's plans to boost power will shave safety margins and increase the speed and intensity and consequences should there be an accident. So that's not a good formula. I mean, any way you look at it, that's not a good formula. Plus, response times for mitigating an accident go way down.
Mm-hmm.
One of the contentions that the state of Vermont brought into the hearing process for this power boost or uprate, they call it, process, we actually intervened. The New England Coalition intervened with the NRC and was given standing by an NRC court called a safety and licensing board, Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, which is kind of a quasi-judicial court. We were given a standing, which is unprecedented. Never before has a power boost been opposed by the public, and more than 100 of them have been granted. Sometimes two or three at the same reactor have been granted, one on top of another. But over 100 of these things have been pushed through by the industry without the public even being aware of it. And this is the first time, and that's why this is such an important case. And that's what has put Vermont Yankee, the New England Coalition, and the people in the three-state area, including New Hampshire, in the forefront of the consciousness of the nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm.
This is the case that has never before been opposed, and boosting power at these reactors is a strategy. It's an industry-wide strategy to boost their market share of the electricity market.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a really important thing, and it's, folks, if there's any way for you to get involved, you should. You can check our website, which is www.necnp.org, or you can just do a web search for New England Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be known as New England Coalition on Nuclear Pollution, and that's where that NECNP comes from.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to come back to this conversation. I hope you'll tell us a little bit more about the impact of Yankee and the distribution of power in the area where Yankee to be taken offline at some point. But
I want to say one more thing, though,
sure.
Before we leave the topic.
Mm-hmm.
Entergy has a three-pronged plan, and they've bifurcated it and tried to make each part of it small in appearance, but it's a big, big, big plan. And the people should know about it.
Mm-hmm.
They not only want to boost reactor power by 20%, they also want to move their spent fuel into dry cask storage, and we started talking about that. It relieves some of the pressure on the spent fuel pool, but it also creates more targets. And one of these casks could be taken out with a shoulder-mounted missile, So you've created another problem. The third part of their plan is to extend the operating license for another 20 years. Now, keep in mind that this is a plant that was engineered. It had a designed and engineered life of 40 years. It's due to expire in 2012, just a few years from now.
Mm-hmm.
Entergy, without making any significant changes or replacing any significant components, wants to extend that license another 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Basically,
mm-hmm.
run it till it breaks.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to open the phones up. So if you'd like to give us a call, ask Peter Alexander a question about nuclear pollution or the nuclear power plant over there in Vermont, you can give us a call, 358-8863. We'll be back in just a minute.
Hello, this is Ryan Primack from Poison the Well. Depression is the leading cause of suicide, and it's treatable. No one should have to suffer alone. Help for you or those you love is just a phone call away. Call 1-800-SUICIDE for help. The National Hope Line Network is free and reachable 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thank you so much, and take care of yourselves and each other.
This message has been brought to you by your friends here at 91.3 FM, WKNH Keene.
Driftwhip, slow flow groove, and yeah, bop, yeah, bop, yeah, wow, world beat boogie. That's what awaits your ears every Saturday morning from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Planetary Prismatic Sonics. I'm Mitchell, your guide and journey mate, and I'll start you off with the space place at 8 a.m., then groove on into contemporary instrumental flow until 10 a.m. brings the world beat sound. And we finish up from 12 to 1 p.m. with a different syndicated Putumayo world beat music show every week. It's Saturday mornings on WKNH, 91.3 FM, Keene's Eclectic Alternative. So rise and shine, brew up a cup of exotic tea, or flick the radio on and slide back beneath the covers. I'll keep the groove smooth and exotic on Planetary Prismatic Sonics. World travel's made easy, no visa problems, no dysentery.
And we return now to Oasis Forum. With we're sitting here with Peter Alexander here on Super Bowl Day. We appreciate you tuning in, and we're talking about Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant. We're talking about Entergy's plans to expand the energy being produced by the plant and extend its license another 20 years, even though it only has about 7 or 8 years left on its expected life cycle. And so, why should we be concerned about that? What is it that they're saying to justify this request for a 20-year extension?
For it yet, but we know it's part of their plan because through our intervention process with the Public Service Board, we got discovery, the right of discovery. It's a quasi-judicial process, which means it operates basically like a court. And through discovery, we were able to examine a lot of internal documents. And we found out they actually call it their big three. I mean, that's their plan. they bought the reactor for $180 million just 2.5 years ago, 3 years ago. And I'm sure that by now they have already recouped their investment. And from a financial point of view, it makes great sense. It's going to be a huge cash cow if they're able to pull it off. And every day that they operate that thing, it generates hundreds of thousands of dollars of profit. I haven't done the math initially, but you could figure it out. They're generating right now 540 megawatts of energy. If you multiply that by 24 hours and then multiply that by about between $40 and $60 a megawatt, you'll see how much they're grossing. And it's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
If they can extend the license, which they can do for just a few million dollars worth of negotiating costs and so forth, engineering and so forth, that they have to do in order to run the plan past the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Vermont Public Service Board, if they're able to extend the license at a nominal cost and potentially get another 20 years of profit, mm-hmm. it's free and clear. I mean, it's free and clear money for them.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly it makes a lot of sense for a profit-making company. What it doesn't make sense for is that Vermont, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, and to a larger extent or to a lesser extent, Canada and Maine and the people in the whole region, assume all the risk. So Entergy makes tons of money. We take all the risk. And is it a good trade-off?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is. And I mean, I live in the area, and one of my motivations is for being involved in this work is personal. I really don't. I'm scared of that plant. Mm-hmm. And the more I learn about it, the more scared I am.
Mm-hmm. So what happens at the end of a 40-year life? I mean, why was 40 years put into place as a good number to begin with? I assume parts wear out, and are there parts that cannot easily be replaced that wear out? Help us just get a little bit more of a handle on.
Yeah, you nailed it. Things do wear out, you know, and when you look at how things were designed in the 1960s, the life cycle of mechanical parts and the non-mechanical parts, the stresses like the reactor containment is a metal body. It's the reactor vessel is a metal body. And over a period of years and the thermal cycles, they call, when you heat something up.